Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell. And my guest today is a clinical psychologist who's worked with veterans for 34 years and was also chief of mental health at two separate VA hospitals. Please welcome Dr. Charles Drebbing. And to everyone at home, thank you for listening. Please take a second to help me grow the show so that I can keep delivering these conversations week after week for years to come. Subscribe, rate, and review the show in whatever podcasting app you're using right now, and check out the show notes to follow me on social media and YouTube as well. When you share your favorite episodes, tag me and use the hashtag GoingInBlind. You can also join my mailing list at ZachTidwell.net. And if you know someone you think I should talk to, have them send me an email at contact.goinginblind@gmail.com. Dr. Drebbing, we're rolling. We are officially live here. So thank you for coming on.
Glad to be here, Zach.
This is, I imagine this will probably be one of the deeper and certainly most near and dear to my heart conversations that I've had on this show so far for people at home. You work in Veterans Affairs. You are a clinical psychologist and you worked in Veterans Affairs for, I think it was 34 years and finished your career at the VA as the chief of mental health at two separate VA hospitals and are still out there getting after it today. You seem to be a very busy person and I don't imagine that that will ever change, but I did notice when I was researching everything that you sent over to me and things that I found in Googling you afterwards. With that timeline, if you were at the VA for 34 years, from what I saw, you got your PhD back in 1999. So those timelines don't necessarily line up. So I was curious, was that initial foot in the door at the VA while you were pursuing your education? Because I know, and people may not realize this at home, but VA hospitals are training hospitals and often partner with educational institutions as doctors in different capacities are finishing their graduate educations.
Right. So actually, I got my PhD in 1990, but I did, just like you said, I started training at the West Los Angeles VA in 1989, and then I got my PhD, and then I stayed as a fellow for a couple of years at that VA, and then I took a job with the VA after that.
And is a fellow post, that's post-resident, like you go from resident to becoming a fellow once you actually have your degree?
Exactly right.
Okay.
So kind of advanced training.
Okay. It just, I've got a friend who's in the, she just finished her first year of her PhD program for psychology. And it just sounds like, I think everyone always realizes that it has to be a grind to become a doctor, but dear God, hearing that the actual nitty gritty of what it's like has given me just so much more respect for all of you crazy people who go down that path. But
it's definitely long. It was 8 years of training, but I loved it. It was very fun.
Yeah, and I was curious in thinking about all this beforehand. especially, I mean, you're a kid coming out of that. Like, yes, you're an adult, but you've been in, you, just because you've been in school so long, but life experience wise, like, you're still a kid. Why do you choose the VA?
So it's funny, when you go into training, they send you around to different organizations to do the work and get to learn stuff. And so I probably went to four different types of mental health organizations during my training. And I could tell you, the VA was hands down so much more resourced and serious about dealing with mental health than any of these other, you know, some more private hospitals, public hospitals. You know, the VA is just very serious about good mental health care. They put money into it. They put research into it. And when I got trained there, I felt like this place is head and shoulders above everybody else. Now, I know that veterans have mixed feelings with the VA. As an employee, I had some mixed experiences with the VA, but most of my time there, I absolutely loved. And the people I worked with were just phenomenal people who are very dedicated. So I do have very good feelings about that time. And I feel like those folks are, the vast majority of them are doing their best to do right by the veterans.
Yeah. And I want to circle back to to follow up on that, but what you said surprised me about the VA being, it makes sense on one hand that the VA is better funded and focused on these issues, but was that actually the case back in the 90s too? Did you feel that way?
So the 90s, it was interesting. We were just coming, it was the very end of the kind of the old VA, and many veterans have told me they had experience in the 70s and 80s, and you know, a lot of bureaucracy, staff who didn't seem to care, but that was changing just about the time that I started there, and I saw really good leadership, I think, in the VA during those years, and things they really did change a lot, to the point where when we would have a Vietnam vet who had not been involved with the VA and since 1970 something. And when they would come in, we would say, you know, this place has changed a lot. We are not like it was when you came to us in the 70s. So give us a chance. And most of the time they said, you are totally right. Things have really changed.
And that's, I mean, today still the VA has a bad rap, and I feel like it is, yes, it still has its problems, and I'm sure you and I will get into some of that, but you know, in my experience, the majority of the problems comes from getting your foot in the door with things, or trying to get your foot in the door. And it seems like more of the administrative folks tend to be the gatekeepers there that prevent things from going through and people getting the care that they need. But every time that I have gotten my foot in the door for care, the care that I've had is awesome. It's just, it's kind of fighting to get in for everything that is the problems, but it's gone against everything, all of this preconceived notion that I had of the VA, probably of the, because of the, that the leftovers from the 70s and before this new VA had kind of come in. I mean, it's even when I shot myself, I had trouble even getting it wasn't me because I was so out of it, but my dad had to get a congressman involved to get me into the Denver VA because I was at a private facility. But like, even once I was in, all the experiences were great. But even then, when I had my face reconstructed, like we did everything that we could to make sure that I got an outside surgeon to come in with permissions to the VA and not have a VA doctor do it, because we were terrified because of the reputation that the VA has. And I would imagine as a provider, that's got to be frustrating to be fighting against too, especially, and obviously you had 30 years of it, but I would imagine that could be problematic with some of the older vets who did. You kind of had to make them trust the VA again as these changes were being made. But have later in your career, did that prove to still be an issue and on a somewhat regular basis?
Well, absolutely. And to some degree, that's warranted. I think there's government bureaucracy that's involved both in getting in the VA and working with the VA that still kind of can feel like lack of care, lack of taking, you know, the veteran seriously. But like you said, my experience has been that once you get in to provide, you work with providers, they are very caring and they really take their job seriously. So we have to, you know, work with vets to help them kind of understand some of that bureaucratic stuff and to not focus on it, to focus on getting better in recovery and navigate the system in a way that gives them the best stuff. There's some really very talented clinicians there, great surgeons, great, you know, all kinds of providers, you know, helping vets get to them to where they can meet them and know that they're trustworthy. That I think that was a part of the challenge.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, you have to kind of separate the provider from the system and make people see like, okay, this is an individual. This, you know, Dr. Drebbing is not the VA. He is part of the VA kind of thing. But
right.
I know a lot of your work, and I'm sure we'll get into some of the more recent stuff that you're doing today, but a lot of your work has centered around suicide and suicide prevention. What was the impetus for that? And then I want to explore this with you and get into the weeds here with all of this, because this is I think where progress comes from is the.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
These harder conversations and these uncomfortable conversations and just being vulnerable in those and frank in those conversations. And I think I can't think of someone better to do that with than you. So if you're comfortable with that, can you kind of tell me what led into all that? And then we'll go where we go.
Absolutely. So I noticed in my clinical training and early years as a clinician in the VA that we were focusing almost entirely on working with veterans to get rid of their symptoms. So we would, if they had PTSD, we would try to get rid of the anxiety and the flashbacks, all that. Or if it's depression, try to get rid of their depression. And I started working with folks who we had actually gotten rid of all their symptoms. And clinically, back then, the idea was, well, then they're better. They're a success. But their PTSD or their depression had wiped out their life. They hadn't worked in years, or they got divorced, all of that. And we were like saying, okay, you're all done. You're all better. And they had no life. And so I started realizing that is a big piece of why people choose to not want to be around anymore, is that they don't have a life that's worth living. So then they feel like, why am I around? I'm going to stop doing this. And so I got very interested in those kind of interventions to help people get back to work, get back to relationships, go to school, rebuild a life. So it's not just enough to have no symptoms. You got to have a life that's worth living going forward. And that's a little challenging, but there's interventions for that. And that became my interest. And increasingly, I saw the suicide prevention benefit of that. And then during that time, the VA was becoming more and more focused on suicide prevention as a key mission element. And I feel like at the time, I felt like I know what part of the solution is here. You know, it's not just keeping an eye on people so that they don't hurt themselves. It's helping them have a life so that they have no interest in hurting themselves. They got too much to do. They got people they love. They don't do it. And so many of the interventions I've been working on with inside the VA and outside the VA is about having a full life that helps you feel like, why would I want to take my life? So it's a little preventive. It's upstream from when people get to those dark places.
Yeah, and taking a more all-encompassing like look at all this, as opposed from just zooming in on the problem or the, I mean, realistically, when the depression or whatever, these symptoms are the output as the result of a problem, right? Like, as so if you're focusing on those, you're still not solving the underlying issue. And it's interesting. There's a million things that I want or paths that I want to go down here, but something that I guess it kind of rung a bell in my mind. I've thought about this a lot recently in talking. Obviously, with my story, I talk about mental health a lot, whether that's on here or in other capacities, whether that's public speaking, other interviews and stuff like that. And I, at the same time, in observing, I'm sure my algorithms on different social media outlets have probably been tailored to that too. And so I see a lot of people and hear a lot of people, and they do have a diagnosis, using that as a crutch and an excuse, rather than the way I see it is you need to, okay, yes, you have the diagnosis, recognize that you have the diagnosis, and then really what you should be doing, instead of leaning on that and just telling everyone that you have that and doing the woe is me thing. And of course there's a time to grieve and to have the self-pity in that diagnosis, whatever it is. But I feel like people need to actually learn about what it is, learn the associated coping skills to counteract the symptoms of this diagnosis are. But you know, if it's for me, it's I've got major depressive disorder. It's I know that I get depressed. I know in these times, like, there's not a whole lot of things that I can do in the immediate time, but what I can do, because I know I get very agitated, I get cranky, and I withdraw, as I can lean more into exercise even than I normally do, which that doesn't change a lot for me. But diet's a huge role in that. Making myself get out of the house is a huge thing, instead of just sitting at home and sitting in it, right? Like, and that's, you see that with whatever, whether it's PTSD, and I you know it's hard for me to criticize someone with PTSD because I'm not a combat vet, so you know I don't know what that's like. But outside of that, I will criticize, like, I feel like that's a huge hole right now, or at least like a trend that I'm seeing in people, that really it's problematic. I really think it is. Did you see I know that was a lot. Did you see that? Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with that? What was the prevalence of that in your work?
Well, I think, you know, I did see it for sure. And that you can imagine inside the VA, the Veteran Benefits Administration, which is separate than the healthcare piece, their job is to designate that you have this percentage of a disability and we're going to give you money to compensate for that. That all starts to, you know, that can feed into that mindset of I'm a broken person and I need to be a broken person. That's the reason that I'm not doing what I'm doing. As a clinician, I always felt very mixed about that. I appreciate that we should compensate veterans for their losses, but everybody has things that they need to recover from, they need to overcome. And all those illnesses, just like diabetes or cancer, we need to bring up courage and go at recovering a life, so that despite the illnesses that each of us get during our lifetime, we still have a life. And that's one of the goals that clinicians have, is to help push or pull or prod their clients so that they don't hold back, so they do go after having a life, having relationships, having work, if that's something they need to do or want to do, so that they, you know, that the illness doesn't rob them of their life.
Yeah. When you're actually working with an individual, right? Like in if it's you meeting with your client and it's a therapy session, always in, I've been fortunate. I've had the same psychologist pretty much since I was taken off of life support. It was like there was a couple weeks there
Oh,
where
yeah.
I was still at the private facility and there I had a different clinician, but ever since I got brought or transferred to the VA, I've had the same psychologist and we just it worked for us. And there's been a lot of, yes, she's a listening ear and a soundboard for things, but she's also had to hold me accountable with a lot of stuff, especially as I was trying to get sober. And I'm, we don't talk about her personal life or her work, obviously, like where that having a conversation for her or with her while I'm there for therapy is very different than sitting down to have interview slash converse with a clinical psychologist. Like, how do you ride that line in those in that clinical relationship?
Yes, that is definitely tricky. But as you work with somebody, you become more and more interested in their life and their recovery from their illness. You're a partner to that client who is coming because they want to recover at some level. They want to recover, and so in the ways that you talk to them, in the ways you ask questions, you help remind that part of them that that. They have things ahead of them, things that they need to do, ways that places that they have to take risks or have some courage to step up and be maybe more than they're being right at that moment. So it is a definitely a tricky thing to do with somebody, but boy, it is helpful. I've been in therapy before. It's so helpful to have another person who at times holds hope, more hope than you do for yourself, and sometimes gives you a kick in the butt when you need it, and that's very useful.
Yeah, I feel like at least for me, the times that I have had to have the kick in the butt has almost like galvanized my trust in her. Like when to know that sometime when I feel like it's maybe, if I'm throwing something off her, like as a soundboard kind of thing, that she's being honest when she's not kicking me in the butt about something. She's like, oh, you're thinking about that appropriately or whatever, where it's like, okay, because I haven't gotten the kick in the butt before. And that it's just that dynamic. And especially I think in the context of as a clinician, when do you share personally? When do you kind of take the step back and just listen, or when do you come in more heavy-handed is very, it's interesting to me. It's an art. It's like a little dance that you guys have to do, and I'm sure you're processing every little, analyzing every little thing that this person is doing. But it's very intriguing to me. But as you also mentioned, I mean, in this whole picture and having to start work with these people and realizing that they need that it needs to be approached with this more com it, I guess, yeah, the more complete picture. Were these veterans that had just come out of inpatient care, like after a crisis that you were seeing, or what?
So we saw people at all different places. Some of them, a good number of them, did come out of inpatient care, or they came out of inpatient care and then went into a residential program to help them stay sober or to really engage in treatment in a deeper sense. But it also we saw people who were outpatient who had never been in a hospital, and they've just been struggling with maybe anxiety or PTSD for years, trying to work. But maybe losing jobs at times because their PTSD was so bad. So people in all different situations. Again, the goal is always to help them function better. Sometimes the key is to get rid of those symptoms or beat those symptoms down so that they're not so troublesome. Other times it's helping them accept, I have gotten as far as I'm going to get with these symptoms, but now I want to have a life on top of the symptoms and get back to work and do the things I love, or go rebuild my family and have kids or do whatever it is. So it's usually those two things. But people are facing that question, whether they're coming out of an inpatient unit or they're an outpatient or they're coming into treatment the first time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I would guess I was thinking, because I self-admitted in 2021 to the psych ward, and it was, I'm sure this is no surprise to anyone listening, the most depressing place that I've ever been. It was inside of the psych ward. It also, I expected a padded room. There wasn't that, but there was bolted down furniture with rounded corners and padded everything, and, you know, no shoelaces, none of that stuff. And I felt like, you know, I came out of there thinking like, all right, this probably needs to be rethought a little bit. But I guess I had, that's where I was coming from and asking that, was thinking like, okay, obviously these people were already at a very extreme low, having gotten to the point of being admitted to a psych ward. But then, you know, although even like coming out of there, like when they let me out of there, kind of seemed like a touch and go type of thing, where like everyone's on a hair trigger ready to pull you back in if need be. And that's just from the outside looking in, it seemed like that would be almost an entirely different place as a clinician if you got someone coming out of there, because they are so vulnerable. And now the fact that they were so vulnerable is out in the air. Like, if they were not addressing anything before, now everyone knows that these problems are there.
Yes. You know, because of my role, I was the chief of mental health at both of those VAs. I knew people and saw the whole process of them coming in for inpatient care, which is one of the most challenging places to ever find yourself in your life, because of the despair that people feel when the control has been taken away from them. I saw folks go there and then go into further treatment after they left, and then go into, you know, services that help them rebuild their life. And then we would do focus groups with people who were 5 years after being hospitalized, and they're out living their life, and talk to them about how did this happen. And it made me realize your recovery is actually more common than not recovering. And that when you're on, particularly when you're on an inpatient unit, you need somebody to say, you know, this feels like a hopeless place, but in fact, you are in all likelihood going to recover from this, and you're going to have a life again you're going to rebuild your life, and this is what's ahead of you. And so you should be thinking about that. What do you want to have happen? Where do you want to be? And that's a helpful thing to people, even in those despairing moments in life, is to realize this is temporary. This is, you're headed other places, and you want to be thinking about that because there's people around ready to partner with you to help you get there.
Yeah, I volunteered with NAMI for a short period, and specifically it was after coming out of that and after getting better. It's to go in and volunteer, whether it was at schools or in places like that, in inpatient wards, to talk to people and share exactly that. Like, hey, I was here a year and a half ago, and now this is where I am today, and this was the path. I'm like, that is there. And I think that is a critical thing to communicate to someone there, because it does. I just, like, the dread in that place was horrid. And it's, I don't know how you fix that, again, because it's people who were at the lowest low, but did thankfully somehow manage to get help, whether that was through their own actions or someone else speaking out on their behalf. And
yeah,
just,
I think what you did is a perfect example of an intervention that we're trying to do more and more. This, you know, my label for that would be having peer support or peer specialists. These are people who have had experience with a mental illness and recovery from that illness, going back into the system and then working in the system to tell people, you know, I was here and I got through this, and you're going to get through this too. That is the most powerful voice in those settings, because clinicians can say, you know, you're going to get better. This is a painful place to be, but it's temporary. A lot of vets I know will say, that's you get paid to say that. You don't know me. You don't know what this is like. But I loved, we would hire vets to come back in and go on the units and say just what you did. And vets really have a hard time not listening to other vets. And when those vets would say, I was locked in the on this unit a year and a half ago, and now I'm in a very different place. It just changes the way vets think about what's happening to them.
Yeah, I think that attitude too, whether it's vets or even, if it's civilian population saying that, oh, you don't understand, you don't get it. I think that's someone who's actually not ready for help. To me, that's what I hear when I hear that is, okay, you're looking for an excuse to dismiss this help or
Yes.
and that's unfortunately, with anything in life where it's, and as an individual dealing with something, you have to be ready to put in that work. And so I do, so I'm trying to decide. I want to talk about the peer support stuff. I know that this is a huge area of work for you, but I also, so I'm going to put a pin in that. And I, because I want to stay here while we're talking specifically about suicide stuff, just
Sure.
with, and this, I'm going to kind of put you on the spot here. This is something, again, I've thought about a lot. I write about this. I talk about this. Obviously, I'm not a mental health professional, but I've talked to other mental health professionals just to asking a very, this basically the same question. And, I feel like this isn't talked about a lot in, I guess, to take a step back. I think the overt signs, like warning signs of suicide that everyone talks about, the Zach is making statements of like the world would be better off without me, or making these obscure posts on social media, or sending people obscure text messages or whatever, and Zach's giving his things away, or and doing these different, these overt warning signs that are talked about. I think they kind of miss the boat on half of the population that we would consider, at risk for suicide, because I think that speaks to, I think there are, when you stop and think about people who are suicide risks, I think there's two main populations. I think there's the population who truly wants to die, and I think the other population truly thinks that they want to die. I think both populations need, deserve, and should absolutely, they both need the same help. They both deserve that help. There's no difference in value there. I just think that the former group, the group who actually wants to commit suicide, typically hides that. I hid that until minutes before I pulled the trigger. I hid that for over a year. I hid that the day before I shot myself, when my parents were at my house, when I had just decided a couple days beforehand in the very room that we were standing in that I was going to shoot myself. I hid that when my roommate came home early while I was recording my suicide video to my family, and then went back in my room and shot myself. Warning signs were, if you really stop and, with hindsight being 20/20, you can see some areas that of concern that were definitely some flags. And then I think on the other hand, the group who thinks that they want to commit suicide is the group who shows those more overt, in and obviously these are generalities, but I think that is the group who, says the obscure things. And it's really what that is they are trying to get help, even though they may not realize it. They're trying to get someone to step in and help them.
I might frame that as people who are ambivalent about it, and then people who are really not ambivalent. They know that they would like to die. And I think you're totally right. It's not that everybody shows signs of it, and people are not dumb. You're not dumb. You knew what would happen if you started saying certain things. You did not want to cue people off
Yeah, I didn't want
to
to be
step
stopped.
in. Exactly. Exactly. Why? So yes, you have to. It means that. Intervening or helping is that much trickier because the people who are most serious are the least likely to show you signs.
In that, again, following this same train of thought, I guess my whole, because it's hard, right? When it sounds like you agree generally with that. And if not, correct me on that. But with that, it's hard because, you know, as the outsiders, everyone wants to be able to, you want to be able to help those people. And the hard thing, kind of tying back into, you have to want to help yourself first, is if you aren't asking for help, no one knows that you're struggling and there, no one can help you there. But, you know, in that group that maybe doesn't show those overt warning signs, and I'm curious to see what you think about this here. Like, it's hard because, again, ultimately the responsibility does come down to that individual. Like, you have to speak up for someone to be able to help you. But, you know, and when I talk about this and people are like, okay, well, if those warning signs don't apply to X amount of people, then what do we do? And I think it's more, and again, I'm trying to be very careful about this because I don't want people who have been left behind by suicides to feel like, oh, you fucked up and this, you missed something, because this is absolutely not what I'm saying. I'm just, you know, if you can stop and look at in your environment, if you look at your circle, and one, if you know someone who you know well and who trusts you is going through shit, like, you need to ask them how they're doing, but in a very direct way, especially when you see changes in behavior that break that baseline, that are out of character for them, where maybe they're starting to be more impulsive and start to take these really risky behaviors, whether it's drinking and driving or gambling or getting themselves into very shady situations that they didn't have, and being like, you know, Chuck, I've noticed you're drinking a lot more than you ever did. You used to drink once a week. You're drinking 3 or 4 nights a week, and I can't get a hold of you for 24 hours after you drink. Like, what's going on? And I think doing in that more direct way, as opposed to saying, hey, Chuck, how are you doing, man? I know you got some stuff going on. Like, how are you doing? I think that opens that door a little wider for that person to catch a glimpse of, okay, I do have an opportunity here to speak up, that it doesn't make me feel weak for doing so. Because I think that's also another contributor a lot of times to people not speaking up, is you think it's weak.
Yeah, I totally agree. The guidance these days is to be direct and you know, very frank in asking people. You know, we're not gonna, you know, hurt people. They're not gonna, you know, be more likely to hurt themselves if we ask them about it. You know, it's just a frank question. There's enough people who die every year from this that we should be asking people. You know, that if I can go back to one of the things you said, I do think the people's willingness and readiness to face what they're feeling themselves and talk about with other people is a giant piece of the picture. There was this really interesting study. I'm a research person, so I love studies, but sometimes studies put their finger right on something that we don't know. So there's this really big study, I think it was like 10 years ago, by the World Health Organization. They interviewed a ton of people across many countries who had tried to kill themselves, and they waited a year after they tried to kill themselves, and they went back to those people and said, did you get any help in the past year for this? And half of the people did get help, and half of the people did not get any help.
Ah.
So is that amazing? And so they asked them, you tried to take your own life, but you didn't get any help. Why not? And the most common response was, help for what? What would I get help for? They had no sense that they had a problem that they should get help for. The second most common response was, I wanted to take care of this myself. I didn't want to burden other people with this. I wanted to solve this problem myself. I thought it would be that there was so much stigma associated with this that I wouldn't do it. That was one of the least common answers. It was mostly about either not being aware that actually you needed to get help, or not wanting to get help because you wanted to prove that you could solve it yourself. So clearly we've got some real barriers to get through here. You know, there's also research in just the last couple of years that said, particularly for veterans, Most of the veterans who are thinking of taking their own lives are not in any mental health care at all. They're not involved in treatment. So we've got a long ways to get to those folks and to draw them into the process where they're gonna get out of this, you know, whatever is that dark place is that's gonna, you know, that's, you know, causing them to think that they need to take their lives.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I think really with both of the populations that you talked about, both the group of people who had attempted suicide in the past year and veterans, like as you were saying that almost it popped in my head initially, like, okay, this sounds like almost an education / maybe emotional intelligence kind of, I guess that's probably not even, yeah, like a lacking there almost. And it's, you know, this is obviously, it's a huge issue in the veteran and first responder community and the world in general, but I was very, you know, it's, the military gets harped on pretty hard for like this being such a big problem, understandably, but like I was really kind of blown away recently. I had a, he's still active duty, but he's about to finish his career. He's a Green Beret. He's been in for 30 years. And it's very, at least in that operator community, at least in the Green Berets, is very open to, supportive of going to seek mental health treatment. And so like he's, you know, he's a chief warrant officer, and he on his, you know, whatever their system is to say like, all right, where's chief at? Like he will publicly say, you know, he's at mental health, you know, getting help. And they have clinicians on staff specifically to help with those guys. And I just thought, you know, that was so, I think that's a great beacon that things are at least moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I totally agree. I remember going to a military base as a VA person, going and saying, we're here to help you with your suicide prevention efforts. And we met with the general who was in charge of the base. And his comment was, well, you know, most vets aren't going to talk about this. If I was feeling like I was going to hurt myself, I would never tell anybody. It's like, okay, so we know what we're up against here. And it is definitely changed. It changed a lot. So it's good to see.
Yeah, that's a tough one, because it's like, all right, you kind of need the higher ups to be leading the charge on that.
You do.
Like, especially in a scenario like that, where if you're an enlisted dude or even a lower ranking officer there, like your thought is, all right, this is going to tank my career if I say something.
Right.
And so if you're higher ups, which I, honestly, you know, if even Lieutenant Colonel, like a battalion commander, came and talked to our battalion and was harping on mental health, and he said he goes and does, I wouldn't believe what he said. Like, that's it's a tough, outside of just time and smaller level unit leaders, like kind of leading that. I don't know how else you do that, because it is such a big organization. But with, I'm trying to make sure I haven't missed anything here before we move along that I want to, I guess, with this, in working with these vets specifically, and I know as your research kind of looked into this and seeing that there, the correlation here was that, you know, there wasn't essentially a quality of life for a lot of these guys who were at risk and who you were treating and stuff, like what, outside of, okay, you've addressed the underlying, we know you have PTSD, this is how we can kind of treat with this stuff, now you're on, you know, you're coming in once a week for therapy and maybe hopefully temporarily on some SSRIs if you need to be, or whatever other medications, but you know, with the goal being getting off of them if you can. What is, you know, because a lot of that is stuff that improving the quality of life, whether it was in a profession like you mentioned, or their social life, or even, and maybe this leads us back into the peer support thing, how do you actually have an impact on building and making progress in those areas that are outside of the VA hospital and outside of your office?
Yeah.
So increasingly, it's the realization that the clinicians have to get out of their offices and get out in the community and work with vets at the colleges and universities they're going to, work with them at their places of employment, work with them, making sure that, a lot of times it's not clinicians, but peer specialists are going to peer support groups or veteran support groups or community service groups and dragging along the vets who they like to work with so that those vets get used to going to, community service and doing stuff there and make friends there, helping them by, getting out of the office and doing stuff with the vets, help them rebuild something that they're attached to. And then the clinicians can stop doing what they're doing. And the vets, they've got a life that, is over and above just not having symptoms anymore.
So these are VA clinicians going and doing this.
They are. So the VA has put a lot of money and time into vocational services. Now, this is different than veteran benefits, voc rehab, VR&E. But this is, the VA hospitals have voc rehab people doing things like, it's called supported employment or supported self-employment programs that are Vital program, which is a program for helping people, do very well in university settings. But in most situations, the clinicians are going to those settings and you see the VA person at your school. You don't go to the VA for that. And that's a way to help people, at the place that they're struggling, build a life there. So it is nice to see the VA putting more time and more staff into those kinds of efforts, because that is the stuff that's going to help people build a life.
And I can't believe this is the first time that I'm hearing of this. Did you have a hand in making that transition into making that a thing?
So the Vital program is a good example of the VA realized we should be doing something like this. And they said to every VA, would you be interested? We're gonna fund a new college program for the first, I think it was the first 12 VAs that can convince us that you're going to do a good job. So, I said, the Bedford VA in Massachusetts, we could do a good job on this. And a bunch of other people did, and they funded 12, and we were one of them. And so I love the idea of VA staff working in the universities. First of all, you're going to help veterans do well there, but you're also going to meet vets there who have nothing to do with the VA or treatment, who need some treatment. And if you can help them, like with registering classes, or they got an obnoxious professor, or find some way to help them, then they're going to say, the VA is maybe not as terrible as I always heard. And maybe they would come for some help. So again, that was a great example. We did a lot of work with supported employment because, again, there you're going out, you're just helping them find any job that they want, not jobs that we have, but jobs that the veteran wants. And you do whatever you need to help them find that job. The supported self-employment program did start at Bedford. We had this wonderful social worker who was, I think he was 60 years old when he came, got his MSW. He had been an entrepreneur and decided he wanted to go back, and he was a veteran and he wanted to be a social worker. But he said, you need a program for the vets who are entrepreneurs. And I was like, maybe we do. Why don't you start something? And so he started this program, and it was just for people who wanted to start their own business.
Wow.
And, entrepreneurs are very lively, risk-taking, energetic people. Different than, I'm not an entrepreneur. I would, that's just not my style. But the people who were, I loved, and that program took off because they had, they got together. They had peer support with each other. They had education to help them start their businesses. And they, they got out there and they did all kinds of businesses for themselves. And again, are these folks going to hurt themselves? They are too busy trying to figure out how to make money and market their companies and all of this stuff. And it was just very fun to watch. So I did have my hand in some of these efforts, but these were national efforts too. And the programming is definitely more supportive of helping people build a life.
Well, and that hits on something so important is the purpose, right? Like, and a sense of identity. Like, if these guys have just recently gotten out of the military, especially, I would imagine if you're a combat vet, you've gotten out and now, okay, I was a machine gunner. I just came back from war and now I'm what? Okay. And now, okay, it's now I'm an entrepreneur and I'm building this startup or whatever it is. And that is so. Yeah, that's another thing that, like, that's, and I'm sure that fits probably right into your, this complete picture that you have of addressing, you know, the entire environment around whatever the diagnosis is. And that's, what was that program called?
The supported self-employment?
Yeah. Support, okay. That's interesting. And before I move into peer support specifically here, I wanted to ask you at some point, and this seems, since we're talking about a complete picture, seems like about the best place for me to do it. I noticed you got your degree from, it's Fuller Theological Seminary, correct? Their School of Psychology?
That's right.
So for you, what role is it fair to say religion or spirituality? What role does that play for you in all of this?
So I went to that graduate school because I was very interested in spirituality and psychology. How do they integrate?
Yeah.
The research says most people who engage in mental health services, you feel like their spiritual life is important to them and they want to be able to talk about it in mental health settings. And no surprise, most mental health professionals get zero training in anything related to religious stuff or spiritual stuff and feel totally uncomfortable talking about any of it. So this is like an ongoing area of frustration that clients don't feel like their therapists and their clinicians are comfortable talking about something that's extremely important to them that they want to talk about. And so there's been some movement in this area that, the VA and other places are more aware that people many of their clients see this as important. And if you ask people who are in recovery, who've recovered from a mental illness or substance use, if you ask them, what was most important, a very common response is, treatment was really good, but my spiritual life is really what helped me recover. And so you can't argue with that. This is a key thing to help people recover. And so mental health professionals need to support that piece. And we need to make sure that they are very well trained to be helpful and not inappropriate in that area, which is a touchy area for some people.
Yeah, and I hadn't even thought of it maybe being an area of discomfort for a provider where they don't feel equipped to talk about it. But because I asking that question, my initial thought was how much of it in your time as a clinician, almost like, I guess I would have imagined that the spirituality is a cornerstone for you, almost like having a higher power is in AA, as opposed to just, having more exposure and being more equipped to hold those conversations. But I'm with that, I guess I'm kind of curious. One, with these folks that, and I realize this is anecdotal, but in the people that you did work with where spirituality was a huge part of them getting better, whether that being from substance abuse or, in mental health treatment itself, did you notice a difference in whether that spirituality being so helpful was because of the community associated with it or the faith, the underlying faith of that spirituality in having this? Okay. Do you think it was more of that?
I think the answer is yes, that it's both, really.
Okay.
Because spirituality is almost always involving other people. So then you're talking about deeper things and thinking about them and doing these spiritual practices, but you're doing it with other people who then you develop deeper connections to. And those people, no surprise, are often supportive and more interested in helping or more interested in you as a person. And so these relationships are really helpful and very positive. And that sense of purpose and of a deeper connection to life or to a higher power, all those things are also very valuable in themselves. So all of it is helpful.
Yeah. Do you know if there's, are you aware of any research that speaks specifically to whether or not the people of faith have better outcomes when trying to treat mental illness?
They do. They have.
Okay.
The data is actually most very compelling that their physical health is better. Their emotional health is better. They live longer. So the question is, the researchers have tried to answer the question you asked, which is this because they all have a community and the community all help each other, or is it because of the actual spirituality? And it looks like it's both.
And it's another part of that is if you are a part of an organized religion, there are values and morals that are associated with that you're probably living, in an ideal world, if you're following that religion or living in line with that are, typically positive things and good things to have in your life. And it makes sense, right? When you say that's not a shocking thing to hear you say that the data supports that, but
yeah.
And you had touched on earlier with in terms of both being more receptive to getting help and, reading between the lines kind of seems like helping to establish a bit of a community, these peer support specialists. And I think I would imagine a lot of people think, okay, peer support, it is, somebody who's been through a similar thing. It's another veteran mentoring / being there for another veteran. But these people are, from my understanding, trained, to a certain extent to do this job. And so in a clinical setting, how would you define / I guess that role and that position that these people play? And I know, you've written 6 books on the subject specifically. Obviously, this is a place that is very special and meaningful to you. So I want to let you lead this and pick your brain on it.
Sure. This was not something we had 20 years ago. There was no position in the VA, or I don't really think outside the VA, where they were people hired and called peer support specialists. I think they had this in some places in Europe before the United States. Now there's 30,000 people in the United States who are working as peer support specialists. And I think it was a recognition that to have somebody come back who has the requirements are to be a peer support specialist is you have to have personal experience with an illness. For most settings, it's a mental illness or a substance use, but it could be a medical illness like cancer or diabetes. You have to have personal experience with it. You have to have personal experience in being involved in treatment, and you have to have at least some recovery so that you've overcome at least some of it, if not all of it. And then the last one is that you're willing to talk openly about it with other people. So you can have any education, you can have whatever, other experience. But if you have those 4 things, and we need somebody to talk to other clients with about that problem, then you are going to be, we're interested in having you. And so in the VAs that I was working in, we had veterans, who would be part of programs related to in the acute psychiatry unit or in the outpatient mental health unit, or it could be in the diabetes program or the weight loss program or the employment program, where these people, for example, in the employment program, they had a peer specialist be sitting at the front door to the program. So new veterans would come in. They're supposed to come to this program to get help getting a job. The first person they see is another veteran, and that veteran introduced themselves by saying, "I was in this program 3 years ago, and I hadn't worked for 10 years and thought I would never get a job, and actually the program helped me get the job, And then I got this job as a peer. And now I'm back telling you, you can get a job. You can do this. And I'm making money and I'm back with my family now and I have my own place. And that can happen for you. So it doesn't matter if a clinician uses what the clinician says. Often clients are skeptical about what professional people like clinicians say is going to happen. But when another vet says, this is, you could do this, have some hope, you know, get in here and expect to be successful, then they do it. So, you know, often that was the role, was to build people's hope, to coach them while they're in the program. If they start to struggle or they start to have conflict with clinicians or there's problems, you know, a lot of times the peer says, you hang in there. This, you're making some mistakes. Let's talk about those. Or, yeah, that one clinician is an idiot. You know, you can get around. Don't listen to that guy, but hang in there. This is your recovery. Or then the last role was to take people as they finish treatment and help them transition to the next step, either back into out to the community or to another program, or so that there's somebody with you who knows the whole thing and can say, you know, you could do this. This is gonna go great. Just hang in there. And we all need that. We all know, we do better when we know somebody who's been through something that we're going through. And they say, this could be okay. It's like, oh, okay, it's going to be okay. If there's nobody there, and if we tend to be anxious people or have a lot of failure in our past, we're going to assume this is not going to be okay. And I need to watch for places to run. And that's what we do. So these people are such a valuable role. And it's nice to see them more and more everywhere. We had veterans in the weight loss program, you know, people who are not thin. They used to be very overweight, and now they were just a little overweight. They lost some pounds, and they would be in there and exercising with the vets and saying, you can do this. I did it. This is what I'm doing with my diet. All those voices are helpful throughout healthcare. And not surprisingly, almost every area in healthcare now is finding that peer programs and peer services seem to really add something nice to the outcomes of the success rates of their program. So it's fun to watch peer stuff spreading everywhere.
And the veteran community almost seems uniquely suited for that, just because of that, the camaraderie of, even if two veterans have never met, as soon as like they find out that they're veterans, there's an instant connection there. Even if it's, you know, if it's Space Force and Army, like, yeah, well, maybe, I don't know if there's any camaraderie to the Space Force, but if it's Air Force and Army, like, you know, you're going to give the Air Force, you're going to give the airmen shit, but like you're automatically connected. And there's something about that. And I guess now that I say that, I've only ever seen that in, or heard of it in veteran capacities. I know it's obviously with the VA, the Blinded Veterans Association does this. And I know it's a huge part of Wounded Warrior Project. Like, it's there. And are you aware of it being applied? And I know you said healthcare as a whole. Are you aware of it being applied in other healthcare systems outside of the VA?
Yeah, absolutely. So particularly, it really developed a lot about 15 years ago in services for people with a serious mental illnesses, things like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, that tend to be tough to treat. So they started realizing, if we hire some of these successful folks back into our programs and we staff our programs to some degree with these people, then the people who come in have a more optimistic view. They see themselves as more capable because the people around them look like they've been successful and they did it through treatment. And so, yes. Again, you can find ways to be reimbursed even for outpatient care that involves peer specialists. So the system seems to be changing in a way to support, you know, peer support involvement throughout mental health system. It still has a good ways to go, but we're making inroads in this, and it's exciting.
Seems like, from the outside looking in, it seems like you're playing a pretty big role in furthering that. Like, what drew you to it so much?
I think I saw their impact, you know, from the beginning, and I saw veterans listening to other veterans way more than they were listening to me. which is frustrating. But when you see it, it's like, you can't argue with that. They're going to listen. They're going to trust a fellow veteran or another person who's got the same problem as they did, that they do. They're going to trust them more. And those peers are more persuasive than I am. And so I'll do whatever works. And if that's what works, let's put money and time into it and build it out. One of my concerns from the beginning was the VA and non-VA people, programs were hiring these folks with pretty modest training. So you just had to have personal experience and be willing to talk about it. And then I think to get certified, you did 30 to 40 hours of training. Well, to work in healthcare, which is so complex, 30 to 40 hours training is the bare minimum, and likelihood you're going to make lots of mistakes. And so anybody who is skeptical that peers would be helpful, and in the beginning, there's plenty of people who are pretty skeptical, when they made mistakes because they weren't trained very well, people would say, see, I told you this is never going to work. We should never have done this. And it was because we didn't train them more than 30 hours a week. So I have done some writing and been involved with organizations like the Veteran Recovery Foundation that's trying to build training resources to make sure anybody doing this important work is well trained to be successful from the beginning and not make mistakes that they're going to be frustrated with or their clients are going to be frustrated with.
Yeah, and that makes it better for everyone, both for the specialist, the peer support specialist, and the client. Like,
yeah,
everyone wins from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
if I could add one more thing.
Absolutely.
So if you look at, there's a lot of healthcare people, researchers, national spokesmen for related to healthcare saying, our healthcare system is in crisis. It's got these giant problems. And if you look at the giant problems that that these people say are undermining our healthcare, most of these problems are problems that peer support specialists can address. One of the big ones that they talk about is there's evidence of a kind of a continual erosion of trust that the public has in healthcare providers and healthcare organizations. If you ask clients or patients, they say, my doctor is in such a hurry. They don't listen to me. They don't understand me. They're really not interested in me. Well, hiring peer support specialists is a statement of we care about you. We get you. We have people on our staff hired because they know you. So they, that is one example of how peers can address key strategic problems in healthcare. Efficiency, that there's some clear evidence that when you integrate peer support and self-help programming into clinical programming, the success rates go up. So such as substance abuse treatment, if you integrate AA principles and peer support things into VA programming, the success rate goes up and the expense to the VA goes down because people start using AA and all these other peer support opportunities, whether that's AA or non-religious versions of AA. They start using that, and then they don't go to the VA as much because they're getting support other places. And so the cost goes down, and the quality and the impact goes up. There's just a host of other things that people have said, our system is failing because of this. And when you think about it, peer support specialists have at least a significant piece in solving that problem. So in one sense, it feels like we've got a key building block to improving our healthcare system, and it is peers.
Yeah. And I think maybe some of what you said specifically, like outside of the VA, applies to people seeing kind of the dark side of the way that the insurance system kind of runs the healthcare system, and specifically like the benefit managers that are, owned by the insurance companies, but also inflate the prices and sit in between the insurance companies and the providers and like kind of like that nasty system. But again, this seems uniquely suited for the VA. Like everything that you're saying sounds, it's a perfect fit. And even, when I was trying to get sober, like just
whether it had been, and I didn't have like a peer support specialist in this. I know obviously that there are after us talking about it, but even just knowing at the time, I guess my peer support that I got was other alcoholics who were going through the ringer as well. But like knowing again that you're not alone in that and that you're not the only shitbag right now was like there's a lot of value in that. Yeah.
Absolutely. You just don't feel so alone. Illness has this way to make you feel like no one is going through this. I'm all by myself and I should be ashamed of being here. And then you realize, oh, no, there's tons of people going through this. It just breaks that feeling.
Yeah. And outside of writing 6 books and all of this other stuff, you've mentioned research a couple times, but I mean, you've published, what, 80-ish research papers. Was that all extra, I guess extracurricular is probably not the right word, but outside of work that you were doing that at the VA? And I know now you're retired from the VA. It sounds like you still keep yourself extremely busy, but how throughout your career and even now, how is that taking place? Is this, or sure. Are you partnering with a lab somewhere or what?
Sure. So research is, I started doing it when I was in grad school, and I just, you know, some people hate it, but I loved it. It is just fun. It just feels fun to me. And so I got hired by the VA to do clinical work, but they let you do research on the side if you want to. And so I did. And then, you know, after about 5 years, a research job opened and they actually paid me for 5 years just to do research. And that was like my dream job. I was in heaven because we were working on evaluating programs that were supposed to be helping, and some of them were not helping. And then we had the data to say, hey, you know, this program stinks. We should close it, take the money away and give it to this other program that really works well. And that is feels so good to be able to make changes in a system that clearly are going to benefit the people participating in the system. So I did that for 5 years, and then my boss had retired abruptly, and they needed somebody to cover for what he was doing temporarily, and they asked me to do it. I was like, no, I'm loving this research thing, and they said, please, just temporary. And so I did it, and I actually loved the administration stuff. It was kind of weird to be responsible for the same programs that I had been criticizing as a researcher. It was like, uh-oh, now I got to do something about these things. And I liked it so much that I stayed in the administrative job, but I always did research on the side just because it was fun. It's really a way to make a contribution that is interesting. It's like solving a mystery. And so even when I retired from the VA a year and a half ago, I just keep doing research because it's fun to do and interesting. It keeps me involved with veterans and with interesting questions. So I still do a couple studies now. And it's, you know, I do it with friends who are in other parts of the country. And sometimes we do it through Colorado State University, which is here and, you know, where I live. But it used to be through BU, Boston University, or other schools, sometimes just through the VA.
Where are you living now?
Fort Collins, Colorado.
Okay. I'm down in Castle Rock.
Oh, so, great. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a bit of a hike for somebody who can't drive. That's a hike, but I'm not that far away.
But, no, not at all.
Yeah. And I know some of that research was kind of on stuff that we've already touched on in terms of, okay, we've gotten past the diagnosis, but we need to rebuild the life around that person as well. But today, or at least more recently, you've been focusing on what the Surgeon General deemed a couple of years ago a loneliness epidemic, right?
Right. Yeah. Again, this is related to building a life, but it ties into, you know, this very large research base now that says that our Western culture is kind of thinning out, so that we have fewer friends on average. This has been a steady decline for the past 50 years. People have fewer friends. They know their neighbors less. They're involved in their communities less. They volunteer less. Now, interestingly, veterans are above the average person in all of those things. Veterans are more likely to be connected, to more likely to have friends, to be volunteering in their community, to help their neighbor. But the trend is still there. And so that it means that a lot of people now are in the category we would call lonely. And, you know, it means that they don't have enough friends or social support to the level at which it impacts their health. So there's been some very big studies in the last 5 years to come out to say, actually, loneliness has a bigger impact on your physical health and your mental health and how long you live than things such as smoking and being overweight. So this is a very giant health issue. And if a large portion of our population is in that category of not having enough friends, we need to do something about that. We've got to reverse this trend so that everybody, again, has the support that they need. You know, they'll live longer. They will lead happier lives. Their kids will be healthier because of, you know, of their help.
The fact that it's more impactful on your physical health is striking. Do you know why exactly that is?
It seems to have a bunch of different causes. You know, one of the things is it seems like it's just healthy to be around people. We, you know, if you just send people to stand in the stands of a sports event, they don't have to talk to anybody, but they're just standing there with a bunch of other people. And then you come, you know, they come back and you say, how are you feeling? It has a positive impact just to be with people. But it's more likely that actually when you're with other people, you know, you got more friends, more connection to family, your information is flowing. People are watching out for you. You're watching out for them. You were herd animals. You know, we know from all those wildlife specials that the animals that stay in the herd are usually protected and safe. And the ones that wander away from everybody, bad things are going to happen to them. It's not going to be pretty. So you know, we're herd animals and we're safer when we have friends and we're with other people.
Yeah, I got just specifically with the physical side of it. That is to me where I'm curious. It's like, okay, is that because most people don't exercise as much unless they're in a social environment and things like that? Like the mental health side of it makes sense, but
it's
just interesting.
Part of the data is that they actually, people with more social support use healthcare better. They have better outcomes for their healthcare. So it's kind of like, you know, when I go to the doctor, my wife wants to know what's going on and what happened. And if the doctor told me to do something and I'm not doing it, she kicks my butt on that. And, you know,
yeah.
So we do better when with healthcare, which has got to be a piece of having a longer life.
Yeah, you got to keep doing your maintenance on the machine and keep everything running.
That's right. That's right.
And I'm trying to think I know you're also working. Well, I can't remember if it was with one or two other organizations. I know one of them was it General Patton's grandson is running.
Yeah.
What are these other side projects that you have going on?
Sure, sure. That's a very cool project called the Patton Veterans Project. And this is Benjamin Patton, who is the grandson of the famous General George Patton. He's a filmmaker, and he developed about 15 years ago a workshop. It's a weekend workshop, 20 hours, just for vets, where they get together, you know, like 10 to 15 vets get together with film coaches, people working in the industry, in the film industry or TV industry, and they make 5 to 10 minute films over the course of a weekend about something that those vets want to make a film about. It's, you know, it could be funny. It could be about the military. It could be about veteran life. It could be about suicide. It could be about anything. And at this point, I think they've made a couple hundred films. And if you go on their website, Patton Veterans Project, you can see great films that veterans have made. But you know, initially I met him because he wanted me as a researcher to help evaluate their program. And one of the things we found was that he was attracting a lot of vets who had mental health symptoms and who were not in any treatment. Well, as soon as we realized that, we were like, oh boy, that's a group that is of interest that we need to be worried about. And the interesting thing was, after participating in this 20-hour weekend workshop where veterans join together and talk about stuff and then make a film together, that in the published study that we had a couple of years ago, 80% of them enter in treatment within 4 months of participating. So it looks like something happens when you're with a bunch of other people making a film, talking about stuff. You realize, actually, I got a lot to talk about, and maybe I should go talk to somebody. And at the end of the workshop, Ben always says, you know, this has probably stirred up a lot of stuff inside you. I really recommend you go talk to somebody. And they do. And so, again, from a suicide prevention approach, this seems like a wonderful intervention to help people, like, get a little unstuck, maybe, like, just to take that step of, hey, I think I'll talk to somebody. And that leads to them doing well. So that's, you know, that's a very fun a nonprofit to work with. And you can see they're doing workshops right now. They're doing workshops in Colorado, Wyoming, Montana. I think they're going to be doing stuff in Oregon soon. They were doing a lot in the East because Ben lives in New York, but it's a very cool project.
That makes so much sense. When you say it like that, that makes so much sense which first that 80% is shocking. Like that's, yeah. Because at face value, that is not something you'd be like, okay, yeah, that's obviously that's going to filter people into seeking mental health treatment. But in exploring something, you know, I would imagine a lot of these guys are making films about something that was very personal to them and maybe something that they have struggled with and may have thought they were past. But then when you get into the nitty gritty of it, you realize like, okay, that still hurts a lot to think about or especially talk about. And wow. Would you be able to connect me with him?
Absolutely. Okay. You know, you might want to talk with him because again, he's very active in the veteran community, does a lot of clever stuff. So.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. That's, and I feel, I know people who I feel like could benefit from that. So that would, even if I don't get to talk to him on here, that would be awesome. So
cool. Cool.
I will definitely bother you about that. But what is this other, what is it's veteran, it's veteran something. What is it called?
There's veteran socials a researcher, Jay Gorman, who comes from Bedford. At Bedford, we started what are like weekly coffee socials. You know, most of the groups that the VA ever creates, you know, people are very ambivalent about it. We would only get people who are enrolled in the VA and they always feel like this is going to be a clinical thing. So we started with peer specialists going out in the community and just telling all the vets in a community that, you know, that every Tuesday at 9 a.m., we're going to be meeting in the Denny's for coffee and it's all for vets. Anybody can come. Whatever we do, you all decide what you want to do, talk about or bring in speakers, whatever. And we did it in the town that the VA was in, and it was great. People started doing it, and a lot of people not engaged in the VA started coming. And then, we did it in the town next to it, and it went great. And before we knew it, we had 40 towns in Massachusetts with weekly veteran coffees. If that's love socializing. They love just a chance to talk. And they love that the VA was not doing really anything in it. It was them. It was their coffee. And they just get to socialize. This is, again, this issue of loneliness. People need a place to just go and where, from this TV show Cheers, where everybody knows your name, you know, where you go hang out and the people know you. And so Dr. Gorman is a psychologist in the VA, and he has taken this idea nationally. And now they have 100 and some of these coffee socials that meet every week. And so I help with that that project. But I think eventually we're going to have coffee socials all over the country. Veterans, it's going to just be this routine thing that many, many veterans go sometime during the week. They have their one or two, sometimes three coffee socials that they'll go attend and see all their friends. And because those connections are so valuable and so, so healthy.
Yeah. And I think something that's important there is that it's not getting VA-ified, right? Like you're just letting them do their thing. Right. Cause if it wasn't that, they wouldn't have the same turnout. I can guarantee that. I'm sure obviously you guys did that deliberately, But
absolutely, we had to fight the VA one. Actually, the people in the VA were like, "Okay, well, we want to collect data on these people." Like, "No, you're not doing that." Well, we want to say this is a VA coffee. No, you're not doing that. This is the veterans' coffee, and the VA can't dictate anything that those groups do. All we do is provide a little labor to get the thing started. So, it's very cool.
Yeah, and having something that's more just natural like that, like. You've set the stage for the thing to happen. It will happen if you just let it run its course. And so take your hands off of it, which is important. But as we start to wrap this up here, I'll have links to your books or anything else that you want me to link to in the show notes and stuff like that. But is there a centralized place where people can find your books? Like, do you have a website or something like that? And you have a private practice as well, right?
I do. Yeah, we do have a website. I think if you just Google Charles Drebbing, it'll pop up. There's a blog on there related to Pierce Services and stuff about the books. So, yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Have I missed anything else that you would like to talk about?
You have not. You've covered all the stuff I wanted. I think we could talk for a good long time. We have a lot of shared interests, but you've covered everything. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think we could too, but I need to hear it about 15 minutes. I need to start getting ready for some stuff I have going on later. So I was like, all right, this seems like a good place to wrap it up, but we could always do this again. So I'm sure you'll have all sorts of, you seem like someone who's never going to slow down. So I think we'll always have stuff to talk about, but well, thank you again, everyone. I will have links to those things in the show notes. Thank you again for, 34 years. My God, that is a long time working with a bunch of crayon eaters in a lot of cases. So thank you. Thank you for doing that. And thank you for continuing to put in the work and doing the research and creating these opportunities for people. And hopefully someone listening today heard something that they needed to hear in order to go get help. So thanks for taking the time.
Hey, I love doing it. Thank you.
And thanks to everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Remember, if you haven't already, head over to my website and join my mailing list. My book is on the way. That is the best place to get updates in regards to when that comes out. You can also rate and review the show wherever you listen, and then share this conversation around with a curious mind who needs to hear it.